The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Start with reading articles from the spring 2018 edition of the Tar Heel Junior Historian, volume 57, number 2, Blackbeard, Secrets from Queen Anne's Revenge. And the first article is Pirate Lingo. Try out these words with your friends on Talk Like a Pirate Day. It's September 19th. Ahoy, mateys. Means hello, my friends. All hands on deck. A call for all to rush to the deck. Arr, or arg, an interjection to show excitement or pause. Avast ye, stop, check this out, listen up. Aye means yes. Black spot, a mark sent as a warning, a death sentence for a pirate who has broken the pirate code. Blow me down, an exclamation of surprise to news so shocking it can knock a person down. Davy Jones's locker, a metaphor for the bottom of the sea, the resting place for dead sailors. Feed the fish, to dump a dead man overboard into the ocean. Fire in the hole, a warning that a cannon is about to be fired. Heave ho. Words shouted when lifting or pulling on ropes to raise the sails. Lily-livered, weak or cowardly. Matey, a ship or a friend or shipmate. Old salt, an experienced sailor who has been at sea a long time. Poop deck, the higher part at the back of a ship, usually above the captain's quarters, same as the quarter deck. Sail ho, a warning that another ship or sail is on the horizon. Scalawag, a scoundrel or a bad person. Scurvy dog, an insult. Scurvy is a disease caused by a lack of vitamin C, a problem for pirates on long voyages. Shiver me timbers, a shout of surprise. The timbers on a ship might shiver and shake in a sudden gust of wind at sea. X marks the spot, an X marking the spot on a map where treasure is said to be buried. Yo-ho-ho, ha-ha-ha in pirate talk. So you can try out these phrases every year on September 19th, which is International Talk Like a Pirate Day, or specifically this year on Saturday, September 22nd, when the History Museum will be sponsoring the City of Oaks Pirate Festival for the first time. The next article is Friend, Foe, or Prize. Pirates and privateers were both the hunters and the hunted. Sailors needed to know quickly which ships were friendly, which to avoid, and which might be sources of treasure. Look at the ship's silhouettes here. Can you guess which ships pirates might consider to be prizes, enemies, or both? Ships of the line were the largest warships. They carried 100 or more cannon and scared their enemies. That's a foe. Sloops were large cargo ships with single masts. They were designed to favor storage space over speed. Prize. Frigates were the second largest warships. They were used for scouting and assisting other warships in distress. Prize. Schooners were popular merchant vessels with two masts designed for speed and agility. Prize. Brigs or brigantines were large square-rigged merchant ships. They were popular for pirating and protecting other vessels because of their speed and maneuverability. Both foe and prize. The next article is Breaking News. Pirates read books. Maybe. It's written by Courtney Page, who's a Queen Anne's Revenge lab manager. Have you ever left your homework or newspaper out in the rain? Then you know what happens to paper when it gets wet. It gets ruined, and it starts to fall apart quickly. Unlike many historical sites, our Queen Anne's Revenge shipwreck site is wet, underwater wet. So organic materials like cloth, wood, or rope did not survive well. Organic items we do find were usually next to iron objects and became caught in concretion very quickly. That protected them from the sea. So imagine our surprise when we recently found paper from Blackbeard's ship. While examining a glob of organic materials from just inside a breech chamber, an iron chamber filled with gunpowder for a special kind of cannon loaded from the back, conservators noticed small fragments had fallen away. They looked closely and saw something unbelievable. Printed words. Even more amazing, they were able to figure out where the words came from. A few recognizable words led conservators to Edward Cook's book, A Voyage to the South Sea, published in 1712. Cook was second captain on a voyage to South America, serving with none other than Captain Woodes Rogers, who would soon become governor of Jamaica and a feared pirate hunter. How did these old pages wind up inside the breech chamber? Maybe pirates grabbed a fistful of pages, tore them out of the book, and used them as wadding before firing their cannon. Wadding is a wad of rope, textile, or other material placed between gunpowder and a cannonball to help the cannonball go farther. It's fun to imagine the pirates were making a statement, shoving a book about their nemesis into the back of a cannon. There are a couple of photographs accompanying this article, and here are the captions. At the Queen Anne's Revenge Lab, archaeologist and conservator Kim Kenyon examines the paper fragments under a spyglass. A close-up of one of the paper fragments. Look closely, you can see the words the, to, may, and atom, which turned out to be fathom. It's a match. The same words outlined are on page 186, lines 5 to 10 of Edward Cook's book, A Voyage to the South Sea in 1712. The next article is Tiny Finds. No doubt about it, it's exciting to discover big pirate artifacts like anchors and cannon. But just as amazing are the little things that divers have discovered and that conservators have been able to identify. Can you believe these tiny finds have survived underwater for 300 years? Sword guard. This sword guard would have sat between the handle and the blade of the sword. The handle is missing and the blade is completely eroded, but a small part of it was preserved with epoxy. During the cleaning process, it was observed that the guard may have been gilded with a very thin layer of gold. However, only a small amount survived. The faces on both sides of the guard have not been specifically identified, but they represent a style known as Regence, popular in Western Europe in the late 1600s. We don't know who this sword belonged to, but it's quite a fancy sword for a pirate. Silver needle and brass pins. You might not think about pirates sitting down to sew with needles and pins, but think about how much wear and tear anything made of cloth would have suffered in the winds, waves, and relentless sun of the open seas. Pins would have likely been part of every sailor's sewing kit so that he could repair his clothing. This large silver needle may have been used to mend sails or sew together burlap sacks. Gold dust. When someone says pirate, what do you think of? Gold. Coins of all nationalities and gold dust like this would have served as currency to supplement the bartering of goods. Trading in raw gold eliminated the problems associated with exchanging foreign money, and was viewed as more difficult to devalue than coins, which often had bits shaved off and pocketed by unscrupulous people. From the back cover of Blackbeard's Secrets from Queen Anne's Revenge, Can you guess what this weird blob is? Hint, it's valuable. It came from the sea, and it's related to pirates. When you go to a museum, you will see many things on display. These artifacts, objects from the past, are often shiny and clean. Conservators have worked hard to carefully clean and repair them. Curators research the objects and then write labels that explain why the objects are important. Other technicians build displays and position lights so we can see every detail. But many artifacts like this one start out as a mystery. From the inside cover, arg, get your pirate on. Ahoy, mateys, are you searching for pirate history and lore? Want to know where you can go to learn more about pirates, maritime history, and shipwrecks like Queen Anne's Revenge? Then you're in the right state. At your North Carolina Museum of History in Raleigh, you can learn all about pirates in our award-winning exhibit, The Story of North Carolina. And there's even more to explore at North Carolina's three state-sponsored maritime museums along the Carolina coast. And avast ye, be sure to keep your eyes peeled for other pirate events and family days by checking out all of these museums' websites. Because clever pirates agree, you never know what adventure might be on the horizon. You can visit the North Carolina Maritime Museum at 315 Front Street in Beaufort, North Carolina. The North Carolina Maritime Museum at Southport, 204 East Moore Street in Southport, North Carolina. Or the Graveyard of the Atlantic Museum at 59,200 Museum Drive in Hatteras, North Carolina. They share a website at ncmaritimemuseum.org. And then the North Carolina Museum of History is at 5 East Edenton Street in Raleigh. NorthCarolinaMuseumOfHistory.org is its website. Think about it. The world is a newsy place. You wake up and want to know what's going on. You want to know what's happening with your friends, your family, your school, and everything about you. Sometimes it can be overwhelming, and some of that news is, well, not always completely true. Historians have the same problem when trying to figure out the facts. How can you think about all the things you see and hear each day? Try to get your information from many different sources, not one person, one TV show, one website, or one book. Ask someone you trust, like a parent, a best friend, a special teacher, or a school counselor. Go to the library, look things up. Can you think of other ways? And What Do You Think? Written by Kathy East, the editor of this magazine. In this issue, we learned that much of what we know about pirates is true, but some of it is probably just a lovely story. For example, pirates really did keep parrots as pets, but most of them didn't really bury their treasure, so you can stop looking. One thing is true, studying the wreckage and artifacts from Queen Anne's Revenge will help us learn more and more. What do you think is the difference between fact and fiction, between pirate tales and historical research? What's the difference between fake news and fact-checked facts? And how can you tell the difference? Don't worry, these are not easy questions, even for grown-ups like parents and teachers, politicians and reporters, especially these days when anyone can say whatever they want to on social media. Think about this. What if one friend told you something bad about another friend you like? Would you believe it without question? What if your second friend said, it's not true, and then said something bad about the first friend? You like them both. What would you do? Who would you believe? It's the same thing with history, or the things you hear on TV, see on the internet, and read in books. Sometimes we get more than one story. We learned in this magazine that a model of an object, like the model of Blackbeard's ship, helps us to look at it from many different sides. But did you know you can do that with ideas, too? When you see, hear, or read something, it's okay to stop and say, I wonder if that's true. It's okay to ask questions, to walk around that idea and see what it looks like from many different points of view. To be a historian investigating history means we often look at what we think we know and then dig deeper. We don't have to throw out all the old ideas and stories, but when there are questions, it's important to seek the answers. And it's fun to know more, to learn new things, and to uncover surprises about the past. I'm now going to read from the spring 2011 edition of the Tar Heel Junior Historian, Remembering the Civil War. And the first article is The Modern Civil War: Advances in Military and Naval Technology by Andrew Dupstad, who served as Assistant Curator of Education and Historic Weapons Program Coordinator for the Division of State Historic Sites and Properties. Dupstad holds a BA and an MA in History from the University of North Carolina in Wilmington. When you visit the CSS Neuse State Historic Site in Kinston, the remains of the Confederate ironclad there might seem like an ancient relic of a bygone era. But when the ship was built, it stood on the cutting edge of technology. In the 1860s, no airplanes, tanks, or radios existed. But historians often consider the Civil War the first modern war due to advances such as ironclad ships. New technologies made the armies and navies much more efficient. Such increased efficiency, however, translated into higher casualty rates and even more destruction and devastation. This article will examine four crucial advances: the transition from smoothbore weapons to rifled weapons, the switch from sailing ships to steam-powered ships, the development of ironclad warships and submarines, and the use of torpedoes and landmines. Rifled weapons. First, one of the most significant advances in weaponry was the change from smoothbore weapons to rifled weapons. Rifling consists of spiral grooves cut into the weapon's barrel. The projectile engaged those grooves when the weapon was fired, making the projectile spin as it flew through the air. Rather than firing a round ball like those used in the Revolutionary War, rifled weapons fired a conical bullet. These conical bullets proved much more accurate and could hit targets at a greater distance. For example, a smoothbore musket was accurate to about 80 yards, but a rifled musket was accurate to 300 yards or more. Battlefield tactics did not change with this increase in accuracy, however. Most Civil War soldiers still told their men to hold their fire until the enemy was within 100 yards, making the rifled musket a much deadlier weapon. Rifles that existed for well over a century before the Civil War, but people mainly used them for hunting rather than as military weapons. In previous wars, riflemen were utilized as sharpshooters. The United States Army has standardized the use of rifled muskets in 1855. The Confederate Army used a variety of weapons, but rifled muskets became the weapons of choice for its army as well. Armies first used rifle cannons or artillery pieces in the Civil War. With their increased range and accuracy, rifled cannons made an entire generation of forts obsolete. Brick and masonry forts, such as Fort Macon, constructed between 1826 and 1834, had been built to withstand bombardment by smoothbore cannons. Rifled cannons firing larger, heavier projectiles with greatly increased accuracy could breach such fortifications rather easily. To counteract rifled cannons, forts built during the Civil War were earthen forts constructed of dirt, such as Fort Fisher and Fort Anderson. Earthen forts could absorb incoming artillery shells and better protect the men and material inside. Steam-powered ships. A second big Civil War era innovation in technology was the switch from sailing ships to steam-powered ships. Boilers fired by coal produced the steam pressure needed for these ships' engines to turn the paddle wheels or propellers that made the vessels move through the water. Even though the first steam-powered ship in the United States had been launched in 1807, the U.S. Navy in 1860 remained largely a sailing fleet. The adoption of steam power aided both the Union and Confederate navies, but it also presented new challenges. Steamships usually moved faster than sailing vessels, a quality that the Confederates used to their advantage in the blockade-running trade. But steamers could carry a limited amount of coal. Crews needed fueling stations and a good supply of good quality coal. Also, steam engines required some sailors to develop new skills in order to deal with mechanical issues and breakdowns, much like their predecessors had to learn to make and repair sails. Steamships provided proved superior to sailing ships in sea-to-land engagements. Because of wind and current, sailing vessels often had to anchor in front of their target on land to take aim. In turn, the ships became stationary targets at which heavy seacoast guns could easily fire. Steam power gave warships the ability to fire while moving. A moving target is much more difficult to hit. This mobility, combined with the development of rifled guns, gave naval forces a distinct advantage in sea-to-land engagements. The advantage became apparent in August 1861. The Union Navy successfully bombarded and forced the surrenders of Fort Clark and Fort Hatteras on the Outer Banks, gaining control of Hatteras Inlet early in the war. Ironclad warships and submarines. Along with steam power, another advance in naval technology was the development of ironclad warships and submarines. Both France and England had created iron-plated warships in the 1850s, and many American naval officers took notice. Both the Union and Confederate navies designed and built ironclads during the Civil War. Almost all ironclads were steam-powered. Most were designed to ride low in the water, making them harder to hit. Builders made ironclads partially of wood, which they then covered with iron plating. These vessels represent the transition from wooden, sail-powered ships to completely metal, steam-powered ships. The most famous of all the ironclads was the USS Monitor, built in New York and commissioned in February 1862. It sank in a storm off the North Carolina coast near Hatteras in December 1862. The Monitor featured a unique revolving turret, a small armored tower at the top of the ship that turned and protected guns mounted inside it. Throughout the war, the navies built many variations of this vessel. Some even had two turrets. Another type of ironclad, the casemate ironclad, utilized fixed, angled walls instead of the revolving turret. This design was simpler and cheaper to build. The Confederate Navy built only casemate ironclads, which could also carry more cannons. Ironclads stood up to almost every test they faced in the Civil War, with the exception of torpedoes and underwater mines, which will be discussed later. Four ironclads were completed in North Carolina during the war: the CSS Albemarle at Edwards Ferry on the Roanoke River, the CSS Neuse at Kinston on the Neuse River, and the CSS Raleigh and CSS North Carolina at Wilmington on the Cape Fear River. All were destroyed in the war or shortly thereafter. Only the CSS Albemarle sank in combat action. Crews of the other three wrecked or sank them to avoid capture. The first vessels we would recognize as submarines were developed during the Civil War. The USS Alligator and Confederate H.L. Hunley represent the best known examples. Like the Monitor, the Alligator sank off the North Carolina coast in a storm in April 1863. The Hunley successfully sank a Union warship, the USS Housatonic, in Charleston, South Carolina harbor before being lost beneath the waves in February 1864. One of the eight crew members who died on the Hunley was North Carolina native James A. Wicks. Torpedoes and landmines. Finally, the Civil War saw the first widespread use of torpedoes, underwater mines, and landmines. Many different torpedo designs were utilized, mainly by the Confederacy. No matter the design, these weapons worked the same way. They were placed in the water just below the surface. When an unsuspecting ship ran into a torpedo, it detonated, blowing a hole in the ship's hull and causing it to sink. This was the major weakness of the ironclads. Most only had iron plating on the part of the ship above the water. The hull below the water had no protection from torpedoes. Some torpedoes were electronically detonated with a battery or a hand-cranked generator. Others had a fixed fuse that fired upon contact with a ship. The same detonating methods were used with landmines. North Carolina native General Gabriel Rains, a West Point graduate from Craven County, developed one of the most widely used torpedo fuses of the Confederacy, among his other contributions to advancing military technology. Torpedoes utilizing the Rains fuse were responsible for sinking numerous Union vessels. The Confederates used torpedoes and landmines at various locations in the Tar Heel State, such as Fort Fisher, and in many rivers, including the Cape Fear and the Roanoke. All of these technological advances played an important role in the conduct of the Civil War. Each one impacted the war in North Carolina. In some cases, North Carolinians took an active role in using the technology, and in other cases, the technology worked against them. These developments forever changed warfare, making the Civil War a time of great transition and change in military technology. See what you can learn about new technology, including the telegraph, the steam-powered printing press, and photography that was transforming communication during the Civil War. Medicine is another field that was changing a lot. Here are captions of accompanying photographs. This rifle was made circa 1863 at the Fayetteville Arsenal and Armory. The Confederate government converted that former United States arsenal into the second largest small arms factory in the South. An interior view of the pulpit area of Fort Fisher, taken in January 1865 after the federal bombardment. Forts built during the Civil War were made of earth. This is a reproduction of a keg torpedo with a rain-sensitive primer as its detonating device. Work on the CSS Albemarle began in a cornfield along the Roanoke River at Edwards Ferry in January 1863. Completed in Halifax, the ironclad played an important role during the Confederate recapture of Plymouth in April 1864, ramming and sinking the USS Southfield and driving away the USS Miami. Lieutenant William B. Cushing of the U.S. Navy sank the Albemarle with a torpedo in October 1864. Plymouth soon fell to the Federals again. And the Southern Navy turned to ironclad ships to try and offset the Union advantage on the seas. Two of North Carolina's most famous ironclads were the CSS Neuse and the CSS Albemarle. The Confederates built the Neuse at Whitehall, Wayne County, to help drive the Federals out of New Bern and the Pamlico Sound region. After being outfitted in Kinston, this ironclad ran aground in April 1864 while sailing down the Neuse River. Rising waters freed it. The crew of the ship, which never saw significant action, destroyed it in March 1865 to prevent its capture. Today, the hull of the Neuse rests in Kinston at a state historic site. There's a quote from Surgeon Stuart Sayers O. Nichols from the USS Miami, May 4, 1864. We fired about 30 shells at the ram, CSS Albemarle, but they had no effect on her. We've run out of time for today's episode of Independent Living. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. If you have any comments, concerns, or questions, please call 919-832-5138. So long till next time.